From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Thousands of demonstrators opposed to the Vietnam War assembled in the nation's capital for a mass protest. A three-hour parade takes the demonstrators across the Potomac on their way to the Pentagon.
The date was October 21st, 1967, 50 years ago last month.
It is at the Pentagon where the first test of strength comes.
The official estimate of the crowd size was 50,000.
Military police contain the crowd, but clashes soon break out. Federal marshals arrest several who attempt to break through the protective line.
Among those arrested, two men. One, a famous author. The other, a veteran. We spoke with the latter, Walter Teague, who since that day 50 years ago has been a tireless advocate for peace. We spoke with him via Skype from Maryland Monday.
My name is Walter Darwin Teague III. That's important because...
I was going to ask you, were you related to the guy that they call the father of modern industrial design? So you are.
Yes. Right. That was my grandfather.
Gotcha.
So I my mother ended up divorcing my dad very quickly, and so she and I and other kids became like the black sheep of the family. So my grandfather, you know, is famous for being the one of the primary industrial designers in the world. Did a lot of famous stuff. And my father was an engineer, and I had very little contact with him. And so, you know, later on, I didn't have the standard upbringing or education that, you know, sons, scions of the wealthy usually are expected to have.
Right.
We didn't have any money. So I ended up going to the Air Force because I didn't have an education and thought I might learn something. And I did. I learned about the U.S. Empire. I was stationed on Okinawa. My political education actually began somewhat before that, when we lived in Virginia during segregation, during the Second World War and before. And I was horrified by what I saw. And I was horrified also that all the adults, teachers, family, whatever, when I asked them, what the hell is going on? What is this about? They basically didn't want to talk about it. So Okinawa opened my eyes up about the international stuff. And it came back to the civil rights movement, and that led to the beginnings of the Vietnam War, U.S. war against Vietnam. And I became somewhat notorious because I chose to take on a particular task, and this defined what I did then until the present. I felt that it'd be a hell of a lot better if we figured out how to prevent wars rather than always reacting. And the anti-war movement in 64, 65 was basically came out of the pacifist movement, the old left, some of them, and the sort of a moral tone. You know, the war was morally bad. I felt that that wasn't going to work with ordinary Americans very well because they were being told that the Vietnamese, Viet Cong, as they called them then, you know, we're going to stab our boys in the back, the usual, right, you know, propaganda. And it worked. People were scared, worried. And for that reason, they would then, you know, support the war, send their sons off or whatever. So I felt the peace movement had to include an educational aspect about why the Vietnamese were fighting. And so in 64, I got this idea. In 65, we started a group. The name was meant to be controversial. It was called the U.S. Committee to Aid the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam.
Yikes.
Well, at that time, everyone would say, what?
Yeah, it sounds like per se treason right at the time.
It sounds like what?
Per se treason. In other words, you're advocating, you know, support for the enemy, quote unquote. Right. That's the way they would deal with it in a courtroom.
Right. I knew that that was the danger. And in fact, my Freedom of Information files showed that the government tried to get me for sedition, the old 1914-17 laws, equivalent to treason. They couldn't do it because nobody would testify against me. They got all these agents, you know, they pay them. And they said, oh, we heard him say this and say that, which I didn't say, because I was smart enough to know not to advocate treason, you know.
Right.
And I was a veteran. That helped a little bit. Mm. And, you know, so I presented this as an ethical question, historical question. And I said, look, we fought against the British Empire for our liberation, our independence. Should we not understand why the Vietnamese might want to fight for their independence, whether it's against the French Empire, the Japanese Empire, or now the American acting like an empire?
Now, this is what Ho Chi Minh had actually been saying for a very long time, that he, you know, he was like the George Washington, and he would cite American history when he would talk about the situation.
Their Declaration of Independence quotes from our Declaration of Independence.
That's right.
So, you know, they were smart people and they wanted to stay alive. They did not want a war. But faced with what they saw as aggression, invasion, whatever, they chose to fight for their, you know, independence. And my argument was, if the anti-war movement doesn't discuss this, it's almost like saying, well, yeah, they are our enemy, and we won't win that war with average Americans. I mean, that political argument with average Americans, because they'll say, well, yeah, but. And so we figured, well, look, let's see if we can stimulate or push the anti-war movement to start discussing these issues. And so we formed this group, Committee to Aid the National Liberation Front, and people would say, what's the National Liberation Front? And we say, ah, that's what the Americans military calls the Viet Cong. So we began a dialogue, and lots of people did. We weren't the only one, but a lot of people did. And within the next 3 or 4 years, there were the teach-ins and, you know, all the big demonstrations leading up to the one where you and I met, the issue of the Pentagon, the demonstration at the Pentagon or against the Pentagon. And, you know, by 1971, things had changed a lot. It was no longer necessary to bring up the history as much, because people now by then knew a lot about it or more about it. And now the war was about how to get out and how to, you know, what would happen next. So I became a social worker, psychotherapist, and did a lot of other stuff in, you know, relating to the wars that continued. We still haven't learned how to stop the wars that, you know, the U.S. is bent on waging. So that's my history.
That's interesting. At the time, you formulate this presentation. In other words, you start to put together a lesson plan, basically, for the American public. And you know, talk about 64, 65. We just missed, and there was a pretty, you know, wide understanding of the fact that we had just missed having a nuclear war with Russia, you know, 15, 16 months earlier, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962. I remember knowing about it as someone in fourth grade, because we were drilling for nuclear war by hiding in the hallways. So you have an understanding on the one hand of what war would actually mean, and you would think with that, with some of the other things that had been happening, with the fight against colonialism, that you know, the Kennedy administration, at least rhetorically, even as it fought that, had kind of embraced, and some of the media had started to embrace here, you would think that there would have been a very receptive audience to the message that you were bringing in that climate. But in fact, that's not what I remember also, that the American people were pretty well tuned up by the media and, you know, the culture generally for this war.
Right. And I mean, my concern as, you know, coming, I wasn't raised to be politically aware. I had to learn that on my own. Mm. What I saw on Okinawa, which is still occupied to this day, primarily by the U.S. military, what I saw was that the government was saying one thing. They called that the garden spot of the Pacific, and that we were in Okinawa to bring democracy and so forth, which was not true if you opened your eyes and you lived there. So when I came back and saw the civil rights movement, I put these things together. And what I realized was the answer to the question of how and why couldn't people realize the danger that these kinds of wars and nuclear, you know, confrontations pose, I think, this is my theory when I formed pretty early on, which was that the history of racism and conquest, which we were taught in school, you know, in the 40s, the 50s, you know, the wars of expansion against the Native Americans, they were a wonderful thing. We had we'd spread the country westward. And the only good Indian when I was a kid was a dead Indian.
We played cowboys and Indians when we were kids with guns and caps that everybody went pow, pow, and stuff.
So, I mean, not everybody, but you know, lots of the kids. And we were the majority back then. And so, you know, there was no questioning of any of these things. The questioning began, and from my observation, began among the people who are most oppressed, Native Americans, Blacks, Hispanics, and so forth. And, you know, and if you were poor, you had to sort of pick sides a little bit. Well, I got involved with the Vietnam War because I was horrified. I saw what was coming. I mean, I didn't know all the details, but I could see that they were going to bomb, you know, tremendous amount of bomb. It was in the cards. One of the first activities that my group did was to try and have a big demonstration to prevent the bombing of the port city of Haiphong. Haiphong is the main port in the northern part of Vietnam.
Right.
And it's where they were getting food supplies and other supplies. And the U.S. was planning to bomb that area to prevent that. And so we tried to hold a demonstration in New York City with all the old traditional left groups and some of the newer ones. And it was an educational lesson for us, because the concept of having a demonstration before something happens, that was hard for people to understand. They started arguing politics and arguing, you know, we couldn't do this, we couldn't do that, and so forth. So throughout those first 4 or 5 years, until by 1971, and especially around the Pentagon demonstration, our group was mainly trying to push the anti-war movement to take a stronger stand. But we were not the only one. There was, you know, the main thing that was happening around that time was students, youth, SDS, for example, a lot of minority groups were becoming more active, you know, which led to Panthers and many others. And the old leadership, which had the money and the basic control of the big demonstrations, they didn't know what to do with these young whippersnappers who were, you know, wanting a more militant confrontation. Now, the fact is, in 1967, when the Pentagon demonstration took place, the so-called radicals were not trying to create a violent situation. They were saying to the leadership, we should have a political confrontation. We should name what the Pentagon is about. We should confront them and force the issue into the media and so forth. And that was about as radical as they got.
Right.
So, you know, I became somewhat famous because Norman Mailer wrote a book called Armies of the Night, which was maybe not a bestseller, but it got all kinds of awards and
Pulitzer
so forth.
Prize for general nonfiction, for example, and a National Book Award in Arts and Letters. Yeah,
right. And what the essence? I'm writing a piece on it, which I hope to get finished. I'm in the middle of it. Should have written it 50 years ago, but I was busy. But I'm writing a piece to try to explain why did Mailer depict the anti-war movement the way he did. And my thesis is that, you know, he saw the anti-war movement, you know, he was supportive of the movement in the sense he thought the war was wrong, but he thought it was wrong for reasons that were sort of liberal politics. And it was not anything to do with history of Vietnam or radical understanding of economics, politics, and so on.
Tactical as opposed to strategic, basically.
Right. And so his book, if you read it, it's a long description of how wonderful Norman Mailer is at a demonstration.
Like much of what he's written over the years, right?
Right. And what was interesting was I didn't know this guy. I didn't have time to read his stuff. But we met. We were arrested almost at the same point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I spent time in prison with him. And his secretary, after we got out, called us and asked for a detailed scenario of what happened. So we sent them a very moment-by-moment history of the entire demonstration that we were involved in. And so I know he had the details. I know he had the facts. The book turns a lot of that around. And what does he do? Well, he praises Mailer, but the way he praises Mailer and Mailer's politics, which are sort of, you know, against the war, but don't do anything radical to change the system.
Right.
System's okay, but the war's not. So what he did was he needed a battle. He needed a contestant to be so he could be the champion. And what he did was he used me, pumped me up, my role up, exaggerated it. And in the book, he writes that he's ultimately defeated me in these big debates in the prison. There were about 400 of us at one time in Akawan prison. I think 700 were arrested. And there were debates, but Mailer was irrelevant. So he writes in the book how he won the debate, but he was irrelevant to the debate. He was basically walking around in his undershorts, pumping his chest out, telling everybody about his great arrest. Well, the people that didn't give a damn, you know, who's this guy, creepy guy, you know?
He called himself the Nijinsky of ambivalence or something, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's all about him and it's all weird and it's irrelevant. And so, but what I want to point out, people ask me, what were the lies in the book? The basic lie is that Mailer was the primary champion and definer of what this demonstration was about. And he should be the one who should be listened to and believed about where things are going. Well, he was wrong. The demonstrations after 67 got more radical.
Right.
You know, many different groups joined. They got bigger. It was no longer something controlled by a bunch of well-funded old, you know, good people, but not representing the youth or where things were going in the world. And so in the book, he pumps me up, says a bunch of things that didn't actually happen or distorts what happened. And there was a debate, but the debate was one that was reflected the entire anti-war movement at that time. The young people, the people arrested in this prison, they were criticizing the leadership for having been too mild, too slow, too a lot of things. And I got involved, not because I was leading it at all, but because they thought I could get a petition to the National Guardian, which was the main progressive newspaper at that time. And I said, well, if you make a petition and you get people to sign it, I'll take it. But I suggest that you not only criticize the leadership, but you suggest what they should have done.
Right.
You know, make more. Anyway, so they were working on that. And then Mailer and I got bailed out at the same time. Some of my committee members were helping to make sure that the pacifists didn't only bail pacifists, because that was happening. So they bailed me and Mailer out same time. And so the young people gave me the petition to take with me. So in the book, Mailer writes that only half the people signed the petition because of his wonderful arguments. Well, it's not true at all. Only half signed because that's when I was told to leave.
Right.
little pieces of history.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's a novelist, so and it's a fictional piece, really. We don't generally acknowledge journalism in the U.S. as being fictional, although most of it is. But in this case, it's actually, you know, listed more or less as fiction, and so
he calls it the history as a novel or novel.
Yeah. So, but it's a form that essentially requires some of these devices just to, you know, move the ball forward. But he did, as anyone who read anything about or by mail or both knows, put himself at the center of most of the ink that, you know, came out of his pen. So, and that's there for sure in this book.
Yeah, it's true. And you're right. And it's a technique that works, though. Remember, that book and his point of view was the dominant point of view in the media, right, if the media was against the war, for quite some time.
Right.
And so he set the tone. In that sense, the book was successful to make the radicals and progressives look strange, weird, or wrong.
Right.
And, you know, so, I mean, most of the anti-war movement didn't pay too much attention to Mailer after that.
Right.
Went on and did what they needed to do to organize locally. Biggest example would be the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, you know, groups like that, which were much more relevant and authentic.
Right.
But, you know, one small thing I want to mention, the conflict was an example of how the conflict was occurring. The organizers of that big demonstration, it was at least 100,000 at the Lincoln Memorial. They wanted to have speakers and no march to the Pentagon. They were scared.
Yeah.
The young people wanted to go to the Pentagon and did, at least 50,000.
Right.
But before they did, one of the speakers that I helped organize was the first Vietnamese to ever speak at a major anti-war demonstration in the U.S., a wonderful man who was like the head of the anti-war Vietnamese in the United States. Nguyen Van Lui was his name. And the organizers were afraid to have him speak until they checked him out and made sure he wasn't going to say bad things, demanded a copy of his speech ahead of time, which I got them. And then they said, okay, you have like 2 or 3 minutes and so forth. They gave him the mic. In the middle of his speech, like a minute and a half in, they cut him off, turned off the mic.
Wow.
And that was, you know, they were scared. It was stupid and insulting. He was very diplomatic about it.
Mm-hmm.
A great man. He was the equivalent of Ho Chi Minh in the sense of dedication, his personal life and his story and so forth.
Right.
Had gotten medals from the American OSS and things like that for his work during the Second World War and so forth. So all of this stuff I've posted on my website, which is redandgreen.org, spelled out redandgreen.org. And I mentioned that because history, and I am positive these days to see young people getting information. They don't read as much books and things, but they get information from the web. They are obviously learning to be critical and not buy into everything that they see, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's really important that history be reexamined in all these areas. In American history, I mean, for example, when I meet Vietnamese, and I occasionally meet Vietnamese who come in to the embassy and so forth, have functions and so on, young ones who don't know their own history, I'll say to you, I'll ask them, when was the first American aggression against Vietnam? And they don't know. They think, you know, maybe 1954 or something like that. 1845. The U.S. Constitution, the ship we all know about, right? Old Ironsides?
Yeah, yeah.
Learned about that ship in school?
For sure.
Yeah. That ship was captained by a guy named John Percival, and they called him Mad Jack. Mad Jack John Percival. And he took the ship to Vietnam, among other places, and attacked, ended up killing a whole bunch of Vietnamese, sinking some ships, tried to create a war, basically. And, you know, eventually he had to sail away. But that was the first U.S. aggression against Vietnam, 1845.
Yep.
And
Percival was some character. He, he decides to do a world tour, in essence, and refits the USS Constitution to do the tour. And Vietnam, that was one of the places that had the benefit of his, attention during that time.
Right. Well, since, I don't know why they did it, but recently the Prager, I think it's Prager Books, which is has some CIA connections, published a full book about him, basically trying to rewrite history and say how wonderful he is, you know, yeah, or was. And it's full of distortions and so forth. Now, this is not unlike the fact that while we're talking, the Pentagon has a new effort to rewrite the history of Vietnam, the 50th anniversary memorials that they're set up around the country, 13 years of organizing to basically say that the U.S. was right in Vietnam and should have won and would have won, et cetera, et cetera.
Except
and
for the this Russians. Going
on all around the United States. Yep. I mean, it's not a small thing.
Right. Let me ask you about that.
Yeah.
And we're getting tight on time. We got about 5 minutes left. But and I want to go to this too, because we had protests that in advance of war in Iraq, for example. I remember on February 15th, in fact, I just saw this go by on Facebook, one of my friends, you know, a quarter of a million people came out just in New York City. It was freezing. It was one of those like 20 degree wind chill, snow on the ground days. Spontaneously came millions of people around the world, perhaps the largest, at least at that time, demonstration in the history of humanity against that war. And within a month, the U.S. was bombing the hell out of Iraq anyway, completely disregarding it. What role can and should people, you know, I mean, we're looking at maybe a massive, like a real war with Russia and or China. What role should we be playing with the lessons that we've learned from what happened in Vietnam?
Oh, well, I think we have a huge challenge because, you know, in the last few months, Ken Burns' documentary on the Vietnam War was put out on PBS, and it's going to be used in classrooms and colleges all around. And it's basically a massive, well-done propaganda documentary.
Right.
But for most people who will see it, they don't know the history. They're right. Not like us who know some of, you know, some of what really happened.
Right.
So they'll absorb that stuff. Now, if you've got the Pentagon making excuses for Vietnam, you've got Ken Burns saying, you know, this is the way it happened. This is how to understand it. It's very difficult to get people to appreciate how we've been lied to about war since this country began. Yeah. The Indians didn't have to be our enemy, right? It didn't have to go down the way it did.
Right.
And so the same thing about the wars that are currently going, the seven wars or the next war, whatever it is. I think the hope is that younger people will be able to question for themselves, is this really necessary? Are they necessarily a threat to us? They don't buy into we have to fight terrorism forever argument as much, because the people that mainly support that, who make political hay out of it or make money off it or whatever, they've often been shown to be corrupt and warlike or, unstable, like our current administration. Yeah. And so I think we've got as much as we can to speak clearly. There's a phrase that we all use sometimes when we're trying to talk about these things to people. We say, well, you have to speak truth to power. You know, you have to have the courage to stand up and talk about racism, talk about what's going on. I want to add something to that. I want to say we have to speak truth about power.
Yeah.
Not just to it, but about it. What is it? Where did this come from? Why do these things, like a friend of mine helped put together a very good play about the Civil War, played at the Kennedy Center here in Washington, rave reviews. They had two parts, one about slavery and one about the Civil Rights Movement, which was good. But they missed a first part, which was, why was slavery created in the first place?
Yeah.
Was it just accidental or wanting to do bad things? You know, it was because that's how the economy of the country could be established. They needed slavery to build the economy and expand the nation. So if we could talk truth about power, then we start talking about the why of these wars, and not just detailed, boring history, but the actual stuff that pushes and creates them. And when you do that, the dots start getting connected in people's minds, and they start saying, well, maybe it's not necessary that we create more enemies constantly, and maybe we're all going to lose. The last thing I want to say is, in the last few years, I've been trying to talk about how we should, again, I'm into prevention rather than reaction. We should have been organizing years ago to prevent catastrophic climate changes. You know, it's nice to worry about how can we adapt and how can we adjust and so forth, but it would have been better if the nations of the world had started earlier and talked about how could we prevent it from occurring in the first place. So, again, these things are all connected. You know, the biggest polluter in the world, as I am told, is the military-industrial complex of the United States. It will affect us all. It's already starting to. And so they're not just abstractions. Wars and foreign countries, you know, past history and so forth. It's current. It's today. It's tomorrow. And that's what I'm concerned about.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.